Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nimco.
You know, I make a rule of never bringing a guest into the studio early because usually what happens, we have this lovely conversation and then you don't get to hear it. Well, I'm going to, you know, I did that today. We had a great conversation, but I'm going to try, screw the initial plan to go through the planned questions. We're going to talk about these really interesting things we were talking about before. But first, let me let our listeners know what we're going to be talking about. One way to get a sense of the future is to see where the money is going, smart money. The venture capitalists, the angel investors, the other sophisticated types in Silicon Valley. I mean, this is considered the epicenter of smartness. So I am pleased this morning to be talking to a longtime Silicon Valley insider, Sramana Mitra. She's her third time on the show. I never have somebody even twice. I've had her three times, although it's been 6 years. She holds a master's degree in electrical engineering and computer science from MIT. She's built and sold 3 Silicon Valley businesses. She regularly convenes meetings of top investors and startups, and she trains entrepreneurs. Sramana Mitra, welcome back to Work with Marty Nimco.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be back here.
Okay, so we were talking about the big issue, two things. We talked really interesting about India, and you're saying India is stupid in the way in which they're following the American model of encouraging innovation with venture capital. Why is that stupid?
Well, it's partially okay because venture capital does help, you know, fund innovation to some extent. We've got some great companies like Facebook and Google and so forth within the venture capital model. But the truth is, you know, it creates a lot of a few billionaires and creates fortune at the tip of the pyramid. But if you're trying to develop an economy that is a sustainable economy, and India is a very big population, to do that, you're going to need a different model, which supports more small, medium businesses, probably not venture fundable. They don't fit the venture model.
It's funny because we were talking about this, you know, and I said, you were noticing that the garbage can in this room was lifted above the ground. And I said, that's so that doggies can get into it, because doggies would go and they would pick through it, 95% of it, and then chew and completely eat up the other 5%. And you said, that's quotable. You said, that's, you know, and you said, that's kind of what venture capitalists are like.
Yes, venture capitalists reject 99%, over 99% of the businesses that seek financing, and pick this less than 1% that fits their model of hyper-fast growth and you know, hyper-large market opportunity. They want to build billion-dollar businesses. They want to build unicorns. These days, the word they're using is unicorns. Well, there are very few of those opportunities.
Right, and so you have a better model that you've been promoting called Million to Million or something like that.
Yes, I run 1 Million by 1 Million, which is the first global virtual accelerator for startups in the world. We've been doing this for 6 years. The mission is to help 1 million entrepreneurs reach $1 million and beyond in annual revenue.
Anybody can make goals. What actually is... Now, and the other thing we were talking about off the air is that most people, and I'm going to be really unvarnished, and this is what we both agreed, most people are too stupid, too lazy, or don't have common business sense to make it happen. You sense you've been sobered over the years because most people really were not all the same. But it takes a very smart, dogged, business-like yet ethical person to go from what you call bootstrapping, starting at the bottom and becoming successful. Expand on that concept.
So, first and foremost, I would encourage all of you who are listening to define success. There is a myth in Silicon Valley that raising venture capital is success. And this is the myth that the whole world is replicating and parroting in a very stupid way. Entrepreneurship success is customers, revenues, and profits. You can be successful at different levels. Building a profitable, sustainable $1 million business, $5 million business, $20 million business is success. It doesn't have to be $1 billion.
Let's say, most people would be grateful to make $150,000 net.
Exactly.
Doing something ethical.
Exactly.
So what do you think, if I was starting out, and I'm no genius, I'm an average person, what do I do to realistically take you? I want to be somewhere in Silicon Valley in technology or whatever. I don't know a whole lot. All I know is I'm a reasonably bright guy. I want to end up with a net $150,000. We're living in a what will be in a Donald Trump world, if that's going to change things or not. Let's put that aside. But we are going to be living in a world that's going to be different than what a Hillary Clinton world would be like. What advice, if you're my mentor, what do you tell me to do?
The first thing I would tell you to do is not assume that there's going to be huge amounts of financing coming into your company. So now you define a business that can turn into revenues as quickly as possible and turn into cash.
What is that? So I say, I'm open to any of it. You know, I know, Sramana Mitra, that you know about big data, you know about artificial intelligence, you know about mobile, you know about online education, you know all about that stuff. Tell me a few pockets of opportunity.
So you have to kind of align this to your skill set. Not everybody has all skill sets. If you do have skill sets that are high-end software, then
no.
Yes.
I'm going to interrupt you and say I don't.
You don't.
But what I do is I recognize that I can be the glue. I know that in this job, in the Silicon Valley, it has such a high concentration of smart people. I can, for $50 or $75 an hour, recruit the high-level expertise. I'm the glue. I am somebody who can think, common sense, work hard. I will bring together the team of people as needed to create what I need. So forget about the technology. Now what?
So, you know, there are areas where you can still build mid-sized businesses, small businesses, mid-sized business, and that one of the obvious ones always is going to be niche e-commerce. You know, niche e-commerce is the equivalent of opening a store on Main Street. So, as Marty said, I was just in India. And one entrepreneur I met, and his story really resonated with me. He sells date juice as a niche e-commerce product to all over India. There are consumers of a certain part, from a certain part of India, who care about this product. Well, that's niche. That's highly, highly niche.
Absolutely.
And if you can find a niche,
great. But that's what I want you to share with our listeners now. I love it. Right. It seems old school these days. You know, e-commerce, that feels so 1999. You're right, and it makes a lot of sense to me. But aren't those, most people would think, all those micro, that long tail stuff, all those micro niches, those have long been filled. Well, okay, so tick off a few examples of the equivalent of date juice that would work either here or whatever, because it's online, it can be anywhere. What are some examples that come to mind for you for these micro niche businesses that are e-commerce?
Well, think in terms of consumer segments, right? I mean, this date juice example that I just gave you could also apply in Silicon Valley, because all over America, there are these immigrant Indian communities. There are immigrant Mexican communities. There are immigrant Czechoslovakian communities.
What about food's a problem, though? Because food, there is more government regulations. There's red tape that is absolutely strangulating regarding food.
Fashion.
Great. So let's say ethnic fashion. Ethnic is really in. So I'm going to, especially here in the Bay Area, kind of in response to Trump, people are getting more ethnocentric to say, screw you, Trump. I'm going to be more ethnocentric. So take India. I happen to know, for example, that silk scarves in India, the blanks, plain white ones, can be gotten for 50 cents, fine Indian silk. And then you can go and import. They're very cheap, very lightweight, and they certainly don't degrade, so there's no shelf life issue. I import the scarves to some dye house, either in India. We talked about Madras off the air.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whatever beautiful, whatever gorgeous designs I get. But I'm no nonsense. I look at the market. I create prototypes of six or eight designs. I stand in front of Nordstrom or whatever, and I beg people to give me honest feedback on the scarves or maybe whatever. I'm going to maybe do a Survey Monkey thing with the different designs, and then I'm going to have them dyed. So my total cost per unit is like 50 or 75 cents. They're market tested. I bring them in. I sell them on the internet. What's right and wrong about that idea?
It depends on what's out there. You kind of have to find a gap. You know, part of the whole niche business is that if you're in a niche that is crowded, that doesn't work. You have to find a gap in that niche, and you have to find differentiation. In merchandising, you can differentiate. I know a woman who actually does tie and dye scarves, and not at 50 cents. She sells at $150.
Well, that's what I'm saying. But your cost is 50 cents. What I'm, you know, I think it's a mistake, and I want you to push back, to avoid crowded markets. Because if it's something new, then you're a guinea pig. If you innovate, there's a chance the market won't like it. You could your little
but
market.
But this is
research.
Not new, right? You kind of. But if you go into,
right.
you know, you if you go into selling the same kind of things that you can find at a different price
not
point,
commodity.
That's not commodity. So that you need some differentiation.
But style.
But
is
in
different.
General, you know. Style fashion is a proven market.
Right.
Do you know of this company called Nasty Gal?
Oh, I've heard of it, yeah.
So Nasty Gal was this woman who had a real sense of cutting-edge, hip, vintage fashion.
Right.
And she built an eBay store and then moved from eBay to her own e-commerce website, $100 million in revenue. This company then made the mistake of raising venture capital finance, mm-hmm. has just gone out of business.
Yeah.
If she did not raise venture capital financing and stayed in her niche and didn't try to grow too fast, this company would have still stayed around.
Tell me why did that hurt? At that point, she chose to get money. She gave away a certain percentage of profit and a certain measure of control to the venture firm. But why didn't that – you would think at that point, since she'd built the business reasonably, she needed more money to expand. There is expertise that is in the venture capital community on how to expand, you know, how to scale. Why was that a mistake at that point?
Look – hyper fast scaling is not normal. Very few companies can scale at a hyper fast rate. And VCs require that you scale at a hyper fast rate. This is the fallacy of the model. This is why I started by saying that India is making a gigantic mistake by assuming every company can scale at a hyper fast rate. Germany is a much better model. Germany has a great SME sector.
What is SME? I don't even know.
Small, medium enterprise.
Got it.
And they don't need to grow at a hyper-fast scale. They just need to grow decently or not grow at all but remain profitable.
Right.
If you can deliver profitably $5 million worth of revenue year after year after year
that's
and make
fabulous.
A living, raise a family, create 10, 15, 20 jobs, what's wrong with that picture?
So what is I don't understand what Germany do. What is Germany doing? Is it as a country or is it as private entrepreneurs? What is Germany doing?
Germany is not... not so driven by this venture capital model. It's a, you know, it's bank financing, it's profitable organic growth. It's not trying to build these, you know, gigantic billion-dollar companies
okay.
all the time. That doesn't destabilize the economy as much.
I want to make sure because I think there was a little on something left untied. So we're both agreeing innovation as in coming up with a new software chip or a new paradigm for artificial intelligence. We both agree that's very risky. We were talking about a crowded market. Like scarves.
That requires tremendous amount of intellectual horsepower,
right.
drive.
It's crazy.
A lot more skills that perhaps en masse the economy does not have.
It's crazy. And even as an individual, if I am not interested in status of being, hey, I got this cool biotech device, or I've got this cool chip, or I've got this cool algorithm for analyzing big data, where I'm competing with the smartest people in the world, and very often my startup idea, if it's any good, a big company could go and squash me, because they say, you know, that's a very interesting new idea that they've got. I am Apple. I'm going to go and create this, or I'm going to steal it. You choose something where the competition is far less, like scarves. And sure, there's a million scarves out there. But as long as you've market tested your designs for scarves, it's a much safer concept. And you're competing with far less august people. Do you buy that analysis?
I do, yeah. I mean, scarves is not less competition necessarily, but you can create a niche where you will be able to...
And lower level. But nobody graduates from Stanford, say, or even the D school, the design school, saying, I want to do scarves. No,
right.
They want to design revolutionized furniture. They want to revolutionize software interfaces. So
there are fantastic, you know, brands that have been created at this mid-level, right? There's one designer that I love that I discovered in Europe many years ago, Sara Pacini. This is not Ralph Lauren. Sara Pacini is not Ralph Lauren, but it's a far more interesting designer than Ralph Lauren.
I am obsessed with risk control. I look at the human beings who come into my office, and they are not born entrepreneurs. They don't come. They're the ones who have lost their job two or three times. They're not superstars. They're not so driven. I have to focus not on, a cool designer. I got to focus on risk control. They typically have a spouse. They still have a mortgage. They may be losing their home. They've got kids. They got the whole deal. And I'm obsessed, therefore. So they're forced to be self-employed because nobody really wants them if they've been let go two or three times. And they're not a tech superstar. I say, how can they run a business that has maximum, while staying ethical, maximum chance of success? And to me, that is a low-tech product or service with very low startup costs, and where you're doing guerrilla marketing and guerrilla market testing,
which is very possible today. And you kind of perhaps don't like the idea of food, but food services, I think, is a very promising low-risk area. If you're a great cook, you know, these days people don't like to cook. Right, so everybody wants somebody else to do the cookings, and they eat shit. So
no, not to say that anyway. Okay, but it's not scalable. The problem with food is
doesn't have to be scalable. Not everything has to be scalable.
But if it's, you know, if you're sitting, nobody in the end, anybody who likes to cook, they say, I have had a million clients say they like to cook, but what they really say is, I like once a month to invite friends over for a fancy dinner. When you are making your living in a non-scalable business as a cook, you are either working at a restaurant working till 2 a.m, you have no life.
No, you can build a business that is a catering service. You can build a reasonably scalable, it's not going to be a $500 million business, but you can build a $1 million scalable catering business.
Dangerous. I don't agree. There's a million caterers out there. They work their butts off on at nights and weekends, and the profit margins end up being small. It's so labor intensive, and you end up being for the rest of your
life
doing
that. But we need labor intensive businesses because there's a lot of labor that is out of work right now. Why do you think is Uber successful?
But that's minimum wage work. That's not a solution. I want to talk about that, actually. Let's let our listeners know. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. I'm talking with Sramana Mitra about what are the lessons from Silicon Valley about how to make money as an entrepreneur. We're going to talk also, I promise, and that's what I said at the top of the show, we're going to talk about where are the smart money investing these days? Where in big data? Where in artificial intelligence? Where in online education? But first, we were talking about this jobs thing. The jobs are going away. Middle classes.
Jobs are going away, and jobs are going away at scale, and it's going to continue to exacerbate.
Right. And Trump, I just watched his meeting with President Obama. I should call him President-elect Trump. Everybody in the media is calling him Trump, but they call the president the president. So I should be fair. President-elect Trump said his number one priority is going to be jobs and health care and immigration. So if you were advising President-elect Trump right now on how to create jobs, short or long term, you don't have to be instant, what would your wisest words be? And then we'll talk about it. Let's chat.
Well, you know, presidents can't really create jobs. The one thing that probably he can do, and there's all kinds of mechanics in this, but getting that foreign stash of cash that's sitting for many years, $2.5 trillion worth of trash, a lot of it belongs to Silicon Valley companies, bringing that back in and investing that into infrastructure, this is a doable path. And this probably is something that the Democrats will agree on.
Oh, sure.
And this one will create
partisan
jobs.
Yeah. Here's my best thought for what it's worth. I think it's an open question whether the Keynesians are right, whether we need a WPA, we need yet more government spending on government employees, but that ends up eating our seed corn. It ends up taking money from businesses and individuals. It ends up being kind of a zero-sum game. So the only way we create jobs ethically while avoiding excessive consumerism is to create ethical small businesses that are aware of the triple bottom line: people, products, and planet. And I think the government has a role as a bully pulpit in doing any of the, first of all, encouraging simple entrepreneurship, simple small ethical services. I think service businesses, whether it be a newborn care person for parents, to homework helpers, to somebody who's going to help adults learn technology, to elder care, there's so much
need
for
service. All of these are service businesses.
Right.
And they may not be the highest wage service businesses, but you do need jobs for low-skilled people.
And if you are a little higher skilled, you can be the aggregator.
You can be the aggregator.
You can
exactly
curate people who are elder care people. You can curate homework helpers. That is the bully pulpit. But more important, the most important topic that is not taught in our schools is entrepreneurship. And I think from kindergarten, running little lemonade stands, all the way through graduate school, I think the government can encourage, doesn't have to force, but encourage ethical, and I always like to, because there are a hell of a lot of sleazy business people. Really, it makes me, it's disgusting. But if we combine ethics education with entrepreneurship education from the beginning, now we can create good jobs, because every entrepreneur creates multiple jobs, and we increase the quality of life without excess materialism. That's my core belief. Yeah. What do you think about that?
I agree with that, and I want to kind of draw your attention to the Uber example. Why is Uber successful? People think that Uber is successful because of this great technology. No. Technology is a facilitator. The reason Uber is so successful is because it has been able to tap into low-skilled people's need for jobs, and they're willing to accept to work for in within this Uber economy, this kind of freelance economy, and that has driven tremendous growth.
I agree, but I think there's another lesson for my dear listeners. Really, what it tapped into is the public found regular cab fares obscene, that to go for 5 minutes, they would charge you $20. So it really is looking for what is an item that is overpriced relative to what a large percentage of the population would pay. And that really is the core. Yes, then it was able to take a labor force that was making $10 an hour unemployed and say, you can make $20 an hour being an Uber driver. But the real core foundational need that was met by Uber was, most people say, I'd love to be able to take a cab. I would like to not have to drive a car and own a car, but it's absurd to be spending $25 for a 10-minute ride. Do you buy that?
Yes, but it would only be possible if you have a labor force that is willing to work at that price point. This is kind of India's magic, right? There's a gigantic, low-priced labor force available. And right now, India is in the one trend I saw in India, I was there recently, is delivery, home delivery of everything. Basically, it's immense traffic, immense congestion, and people want things to be delivered.
I want to, my board operator raised a question. I don't want to discuss it, but I just want to make, she made a point that I want to say. If Trump follows through, and I want, again, I'm sorry, I'm calling him Trump, President-elect Trump, again, I'm just being fair because they, you know, the media always calls Obama President Obama. If President-elect Trump indeed follows through with his promise to lower taxes, but he also calls for more infrastructure, that's going to mean that if that's true, you know, that is could create more deficits, and that could cause more recession. And I think that's a legitimate, absolutely legitimate point. Like everything in life, though, everything is a matter of balance, as trade-offs. And I hope that
except if you can get that that foreign cash back in, that's $2.5 trillion taxed at 10% is a $250 billion.
Good point. And also, it depends, I guess, on how the taxes. And again, some of it could be cut in. There are certainly nobody would say that government is efficient. You know, there is a massive inefficiency. So if in fact he can be tougher on cutting waste, fraud, waste, and abuse, that could create some money too. But that's off topic for the show. I need to stay focused on the career stuff. So let's now go back to the core function of what we were going to be talking about. First, let our listeners know you're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. I'm talking with Sramana Mitra, a true Silicon Valley insider. LinkedIn named her one of the top influencers in all of Silicon Valley. You have spent so much time talking to angel investors, startup people. Let's take these one at a time. Big data has been a hot field for a few years.
Very hot.
Right. Is it accelerating? Is it declining? And is there a niche within it that my dear listeners might jump on that bandwagon?
The way to think about the big data opportunities is in every vertical sector of industry, there are big data opportunities. So you can take the basic big data principles and apply it to healthcare, apply it to transportation, apply it to
absolutely
anything, manufacturing, services, logistics.
So let's
everything.
Flesh it out. So for healthcare, that would mean, for example, that they're trying to figure out which medications really are cost, which treatments or which are cost effective. If you can massively look at this large database at different kind of people with different kind of problems, let's say cardiac stents, you know, given his blood pressure, given his age, given his cardio CRP, given this, given the particular surgeons we have, we're operating.
Given what other medications he's on,
right.
What are the side effects, you can triangulate.
Cost effect, basically,
a multivariate optimization that you put on top of the data.
Exactly. And then you can say, okay, for this particular person, it is not cost effective for Kaiser Permanente to offer him this stent. It would be better to treat it with medication or vice versa. That's what you're talking about?
It's one example,
right,
a very
right,
good
right.
example, yeah.
Right. Okay, pick one. What's another example you like to talk about?
So You know, one of my favorite examples is, remember when advertising agencies did media buying manually? You know, they decide you buy this much advertising on this media, that much advertising on that media. And today, in the days of real-time ad serving online, this is no longer viable manually. Everything has to be data-driven and everything has to be real-time and in like, you know, nanosecond decisions. None of this is any more manual. Everything is big data. Everything is artificial intelligence. There's lots of machine learning in this.
So give me a sense. Let's take our scarf example. I like to have that same theme. Let's say I've market tested some scarves. I bought the blanks in India for 50 cents. I've got them made at a dye house for 25. My cost manufacturer is 75 cents. I'm selling for $20. How could I use big data if I'm not a huge corporation? How can I use big data to help me sell more scarves ethically?
So big data, by definition, you need data to be able to use
that. Can I buy that data? Can I buy data?
You cannot. For this example, I don't think you can necessarily buy data. You're going to have to accumulate some data in the process and
too
then
hard.
Be able to use data.
That's too hard.
So I think that part of the issue that you are pointing to is that is big data usable for little companies? Mm-hmm. It is usable to the extent that you're using for marketing this kind of targeting. So Facebook, for instance, is a tremendous blessing for little companies.
Tell me.
In your scarf example, if you're trying to find a niche audience of women who wear these scarves, of a certain, you know, in a certain community, certain...
Or a man. Your husband is right here. He's wearing a scarf right now.
Wearing a scarf that I just got him from India. So whatever, I mean, you kind of figure out where to target this. Now Facebook gives you the tools to do hyper-targeting. And that is based on big data, completely based on big data.
Now, for the job seeker. I know, look, if I'm a brilliant software engineer, an applied mathematician, somebody who's an expert at, you know, multivariate analysis or whatever, even if I have a degree in theoretical physics, it would apply to getting a job in big data. But most of my listeners, most human beings are not that. They are normal people. They typically do have a college degree or they're bright. They realize a college wasn't worth the money and they dropped out, but they're reasonably bright, but they're not that technical.
That's right.
Is there any place for them in the world of big data?
Not on the production side, on the consumption side, yes. Like I said, you can be the beneficiary of what big data delivers for you because, you know, for example, Facebook offers you hyper-targeting based on big data, but you're not going to be able to program big data.
Okay.
Unless you're a
genius. About sales? What about companies that are in the big data business? You know, they all need HR people. They all need accountants. They all need sales. They all need janitors.
Sure.
Would it be smart to target your job search if you are not a technical person? You know, it's like and try to work for those companies because they're going to be more likely to pay you decently because they're in growth mode. They're not in starvation mode.
That's
and
right.
They're going to pay you $10 an hour.
So these are the hottest companies in the industry right now. Anything to do with big data, artificial intelligence, machine learning in multiple different segments.
What are a couple
very,
of names of companies
hot.
That are really good and therefore they've got enough money to not treat you like crap?
Palantir.
Palantir. I know. I've heard of them. Yep. What else?
Splunk.
Oh, yes. Right. Splunk. Good.
These are all, you know, very of a certain scale, actually. There are many others in this segment. But these are names that you would recognize easily.
Perfect. And you just, in passing, you mentioned the word artificial intelligence. Now, there's a feel for, I've been around, I'm over 50, and I've been around since I started. All I keep hearing about is the promise of artificial intelligence, and it has not come to pass. Is it different now, or is it still in the hypey stage?
No, it's not. It's actually very much in action right now. This example that I gave you of marketing, you know, advertising, targeting, serving in real time ads and so forth, that's all artificial intelligence, and that whole field will not function without machine learning at this point. Similarly, if you look at cybersecurity, you know, cybersecurity is a very hot field today, and it's a very important field because we are so exposed in every possible way. Cybersecurity is also using artificial intelligence in a very big way.
Now, many of the listeners to the show really hate corporate America. They hate companies. They would love to work for the government. Government is also very much involved in big data, I would guess, artificial intelligence, certainly cybersecurity, which has made me think of it.
Cybersecurity, for sure.
Right. Where could there be... Again, I'm interested in the not super technical person. Do you have any idea?
Cybersecurity is not for not so super technical people.
It's
like
it's all algorithmic.
Yeah. Okay. It's incredibly high-powered
technology. Where is there a niche that is in the tech world that feel that might be a better point of entry for your average person?
Well, you know, there is a lot of programming that still goes on by hand at every level. There's mobile app programming here. There is, you know, web
That's
app
still very
programming.
Technical. First of all, okay, let's say I'm not a programmer, but all I'm hearing from everybody is that software engineers have all this great job opportunity. They used to call them programmers, now they're software engineers. And so I say, okay, I want a quick and dirty Band-Aid. I'm going to go to a coding boot camp. What do you really think? Are those worth it, and for whom and why?
They are worth it because there are still lots of coding jobs all over the world. If you look at job openings versus how people who are applying, coding jobs are still available. Now, this will actually, over time, this is going to change because the low-end coding jobs are going to get automated by artificial intelligence with code generators, and that is going to go away.
And even before that, it's a race to the bottom because coding, where the work product is sent over the internet, it can be done for $3 an hour or $5 an hour in India.
Or elsewhere.
So is it foolish to go into any career in which the work product can be sent overseas because you're competing with $3 an hour people?
Well, this is part of the issue that we are facing right now is why did President-elect Trump get elected is because there has been a tremendous job loss due to automation as well as outsourcing and globalization aided by technology. And that's, you know, this is kind of rage of those disenfranchised and this, you know.
Are you, as somebody, I want you to put on your stateswoman hat. You are a person who originally was from India. You spent a lot of time here. I don't want you to, you know, I know you'd lean capitalistically, but I want you to be as stateswomanly as you could. A lot of the anger here in the Bay Area has been about H-1B visas, mm-hmm. where people are being imported by companies from India and China and other countries to do work. And generally, while the law officially says they got to be paid the same, in reality, they are treated worse, the longer hours, etc. Do you, again, if you were advising President Trump as a world citizen interested in the human beings of India as much as those in this country, would you curtail H-1B visas? What would you do to try to do the greatest good for the greatest number of human beings worldwide?
Well, I think this is a very complex question at
it
the
sure
moment
is.
Because the truth is the whole globalization phenomenon aided by technology has been a zero-sum game. India has developed, and many other countries, China has developed, by taking the outsourcing work from the mm-hmm. United States and Western Europe. And that has been a zero-sum game. There have been people who have lost on this side of the table.
What so if I said it's not nowhere near a zero-sum game? Because let's say this person who is in California, who loses the job to somebody in Mumbai, that person in America still, in general, has a much higher standard of living, even if he or she's got to work at Walmart, than the person in India who may have really been starving and living much worse, especially if they had come from rural India and migrated or wherever to a larger city. Isn't it true net-net in terms of humankind the world is better because we've improved the life of the Indian more than we've hurt the life of the American?
Perhaps, but if you talk to the person whose job has been outsourced, that's not how they think, and this is what is driving the
yes.
whole Trump election.
But ultimately, that's not rationality. Real rationality is really, you know, I feel, I've said this before on the radio, I have as much solidarity from someone in Hyderabad as someone who is in Sacramento.
So do I. So from a global optimization point of view, we are making progress. From a poverty reduction, worldwide poverty reduction point of view, we're making progress. But this is not how the person whose job is getting outsourced is not
right.
how they're thinking.
But right, they're not. And what we must, and that is what I urge everybody to do, whether you are a Trump supporter, and there are very few in the Bay Area, or you are a Clinton supporter, please think in terms of not just, I lost my job, I want to. We really do need to think cosmically. There's nothing in my mind more important than considering all of the cosmic implications of every act. When they say think globally and act locally, go ahead.
But with artificial intelligence, now we are creating a cosmic problem, which is not going to be, nobody's going to win from this from a humanity point of view. There's going to be a group of people who are going to make shitloads of money. I'm sorry, truckloads of money. And these people are going to you know, they are going to be the owners of these artificial intelligence companies that are going to mint money, absolutely, through robotics, through automation, and so forth. But there's going to be huge, huge, huge numbers of people who are going to have no jobs, not in India, not in China, not
you're
in
right.
America, nowhere.
I know you're right. And therefore, and for them, the realistic answer, alas, and it's easy for me to say because I have money, but I swear on my life that if I had no money, very minimal, like guaranteed income, we talked off the air about guaranteed income. I really believe we need to have a guaranteed
income.
We do annual
need a guaranteed.
Everybody.
There is no choice. We do need a universal basic income that can.
But if it was really basic, I swear, let's say I was making $20,000 a year and a basic guaranteed income and basic health care, not Lexus quality health care, basic, a 20-year-old Toyota, you know, all that stuff. I profoundly believe that if I had the right attitude, my quality of life would be better.
Absolutely.
I could focus more on relationships, on creative outlets, on being kind, etc., instead of the material acquisition game. And I think that, ultimately, is going to be what's required. You get most people who are not going to be geniuses in artificial intelligence or not entrepreneurs or whatever to realize that the meaning of life does primarily reside in creative outlet, kindness, relationships. Do you buy that?
I buy that partially. The problem is that a lot of people in that scenario, a lot of people are going to operate as zombies. They're just going to sit and watch television or play computer games, get addicted to computer games, and do nothing. They're
is
not
that
going
so terrible?
To.
Is that so? I mean, I went through a period of my life when I was in graduate school, ironically, where I played video games for 6 hours a day and I loved it. And I, when I was younger, I loved television. Is that so terrible?
Yeah, we're going to have obese zombies. Is that so terrible? You ask yourself. I think it's going to be pretty terrible.
I think if they have a better option, they do. But let's say somebody is unable to find good work. If we can, we don't need to illegitimate. It's not that they're lazy. It's that the world will have changed so much that they are unviable at any kind of a living wage.
That's right.
And that's so fine. That poor schnook who happened to have been born at the wrong time in history rather than at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution where there were jobs, you know what? Let's honor this person and say, let's look, give you opportunities for volunteer work. Let's not ridicule you for watching TV.
I think we do need to create a completely different norm for society of what is considered successful, what is considered dignified in society.
Correct.
That needs to be reconfigured and rethought through.
Correct. Now, if somebody has great potential and chooses to be lazy, I have no sympathy. If somebody had the ability to create an ethical business or to be a very good programmer or whatever and chooses instead to just get stoned and sit and watch video games, I have no respect. But some person who had the misfortune of, say, being born into a family where they really weren't that smart or that driven or whatever, and now they were struggling in school to get C's and whatever, it's in large measure externalities. It's not really their fault in many ways.
Or just genetically,
right.
They're mediocre.
Right.
And then there is more of those than the elite, brilliant people.
Well, there is, right, by definition. And it's so I'm saying it's not their fault. So should we legitimate if somebody's made a reasonable effort to find work, and then the best they can do is minimum wage, 20 hours a week, and then they play video games and watch TV, and even get stoned. Let's even go there. If your life is unhappy enough, you know, allowing a little bit of a bomb. Yes, marijuana does without question reduce motivation, does without doubt reduce memory, and it increases cardiovascular risk. I reviewed the literature for Time magazine. But still, it's not so much to be disparaged, especially given it's already been legalized in all these states now. It is in the absence of jobs rather than make some BS statements about how we're going to create jobs for everybody, which is just political BS.
I think it's political BS.
I think we need to legitimate even a lazy lifestyle for many people. What do you think of that radical idea?
Yeah. If it's a lazy lifestyle that doesn't harm anybody, that's great. If it's a lazy lifestyle that out of frustration creates criminal activities, this is not good.
Couldn't agree more. What a great time. I'm not letting you go. We have a great time talking together. Give me your hand. I love her. I'm just holding her hand now because I just love her. Anyway, you're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. I am talking with Sramana Mitra, whom LinkedIn called one of the 10 top influencers of all of Silicon Valley. And she's known it all. She's,
of the world, actually.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
The world, wow.
Number one is Bill Gates. Number two is Richard Branson.
Wow. And remember, she's no lightweight. She's got a master's in electrical engineering, computer science from MIT. She's built and sold 3 Silicon Valley businesses. She regularly convenes meetings of top investors and startups, trains entrepreneurs. She's hot. So now I invite you to call. So we've been having a very wide-ranging conversation that spanned what I really like, which is both the practical, what you should do, whether you are somebody, quote, fairly unemployable, and what you could be doing, to high-level people who could start businesses, to people in the middle of small businesses. We've also talked about the macro societal problem. If you have a comment or a question related to the world of work, especially related to technology, we invite you to call the phone number here, Work with Marty Nenko, with my wonderful guest, Sumamana Mitra, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And even before I get with the phone number, the number of the calls are coming in, welcome to the show. It is your turn on the air. What is your question or comment first for Sumamana Mitra?
Oh, thank you so much. This is a fascinating show, and I appreciate it, but I also find it very depressing because, again, we're focusing on, you know, the few people who are going to benefit. And
yeah, we've talked about everybody. I don't know if you just joined us. We've been talking about the poor, the unemployable as well. That really.
Yeah. I know that. And so now marijuana has been legalized just in time for them to, get a bong and maybe take it one step further and give them the option of euthanasia. I mean, why are we focusing on this instead of redistribution? Better methods and strategies for redistributing
universal basic
money
income
and
is a redistribution message.
That universal basic income is redistributing money from the taxpayer to people who are not working. So let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nenko, Sumamana Mitra. What's your question or comment for her?
Oh yeah, hi. My comment is this: is that we would have to nationalize regarding income. We nationalize those money-making ventures. We just take them over. The state does. And therefore, you don't have these money-making megalomaniacs. And second, if that was not
that's going to be a disaster.
You have a revolution, basically, because that's what would happen. People have to work. And the big challenges for our society is to make people so that we can work. And I actually kind of resent the way you guys speak about low-income people or people like the Uber, low-income, only being able to apply to Uber. I know a lot of college professors are driving Uber. So, that's my comment. Thank
you. But that's not the majority of the Uber drivers.
Yeah. So, he was arguing for nationalization of most businesses to create jobs. You then said you couldn't restrain yourself and you said it was a disaster. Tell me what you mean by that.
Well, the reason capitalism works is because there's capitalism accounts for and acknowledges a basic human instinct, which is self-interest and the desire for self-actualization. If you take that away and nationalize everything, I don't think you would be able to harness the energy and the entrepreneurship and the enterprise of the talented people. That's just a basic reality.
And the caller, just taking the caller's position for the moment, the notion is that's true. Of course, capitalism harnesses energy, but there are so many winners, so few relative winners and so many losers in capitalism that this caller believes that it would be wiser to sacrifice the motivational effect of capitalism in exchange for making things more equal to those people who are not smart enough, driven enough, well-funded enough.
Then you will not have any wealth to distribute. You kind of need the capitalist to create the wealth with which you can then, harness the taxation and redistribution, fund the redistribution to do universal basic income.
Let's go back to the phones. All the lines are lighted up. Welcome to Work with Marty Nenko. What's your question or comment for Sumamana Mitra about the future and present of work, especially regarding Silicon Valley? Hi, it's you.
Am I on now?
You are.
Hi, this is Sandra in Santa Cruz. I have two comments. One is that I really want to hear what your guest has to say. And you keep doing this man thing or interrupting her all the time. I'm getting a headache from the stress of that.
Okay, Sumamana, do you feel that...
I don't. I don't. Sandra. Nobody stops me from talking if I want to. So what is your question? Let's ask me a question.
Yeah,
I will answer
and I
your question.
No, I need to comment about that first. There is an appropriate... There are different styles. But I am obsessed with the idea of making the most of every minute. And so she has the right, and she does interrupt me. And I interrupt her when I feel it is in the best interest of listeners. To play gender games and say it's mansplaining is really, again, that kind of labeling is really devastating and dangerous. You said you had a second point. If it's substantive,
yes,
I welcome you.
My second point is the whole idealistically, sure, making your comment about making $20,000 a year and the most important thing is being kind and all that stuff. But I just want to remind you about Maslow's hierarchy of needs. There's no self-actualization in there.
Yes, and so, I think that's something that I completely agree with, that lack of self-actualization in that model of universal basic income is a gigantic problem, because human beings want to self-actualize, and that is, short of that, when people don't have a meaning for their existence, they tend to do hanky-panky and bad things.
And that's why I use the term creative outlets. Most people's self-actualization comes from a measure of control, whether it be they're a musician or they're a writer or they're a scientist. And so, you know, one doesn't need money to be self-actualized. And I couldn't, on that point of agreement, I do agree with you there. So I thank you for the call. All our lines are lighted up. Let's keep going back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nengpo, Sramana Mitra. What is your question or comment for her?
I don't understand why you're putting the onus of responsibility on the people, the working poor, that they're supposed to be kind, that they're supposed to have a good attitude. What about the plutocrats who are making billions of dollars, the CEOs who have these huge golden parachutes when they even screw up their companies? Where is the justice in that? And where, you know, how can we address equilibrium?
There are two answers to your question. One is that this whole proposition of universal basic income assumes that those plutocrats who are making the money are going to be financing that, because that's the only way this is going to be affordable. That's number one. Number two is, just the same way that you have a lot of people who are irresponsible, kind of, you know, entitled maniacs, you also have people like Bill Gates who are doing a tremendous amount to support incredibly fantastic projects, healthcare projects, malaria, cure and polio cure and so on and so forth. And you have to give credit where it's due.
I want to thank you for the call. You know, of course, there was no implication from either of us that only the poor should be kind. Of course, kindness should be at the core of all kindness and utilitarian justice should be at the core of everybody. And I know that neither of us was implying so. If the caller was wanting clarification on that, clearly there should not be a monopoly. And there is some noblesse oblige required. We call it these days white male privilege. But whatever it is, if for both genetic, environmental, and societal, you have made a lot of money, and believe me, I think that there are, you know, I am fortunate that a significant percentage of my practice is with some very successful people, my career counseling practice, and across the political spectrum, from those who are wealthy but in the far left and wealthy who are in the far right, they feel a tremendous sense of voluntarism to donate large amounts of money to charities.
And a lot of people are donating huge amounts of money or trying to make a difference.
Let me ask that question pointedly. Think about, you know, you do know a lot of the wealthy people in Silicon Valley. In your honor, and be completely honest, don't just maintain your pro-capitalist position here. Are they cruel people who are not generous? Do they give a lot of money? Do they care about society? Or they just want to pad their bank accounts?
No, I think there are lots of people. Look at Zuckerberg. You know, I think he's a kid compared to me. I'm ancient compared to Zuckerberg. And I'm not that old. So, but this kid is incredibly responsible, and he's very wealthy and everything.
Is he an outlier?
He's also donated.
Is he an outlier? But look at.
No, I don't think he's an outlier. So look
okay.
at Mark Benioff. Mark Benioff.
Those are outliers too. What if we fill the room with 100 people you know best, who have either been at who just know best in Silicon Valley, who are making more than $200,000 a year? What percentage of them would you say are just mainly interested in just padding their bank account versus trying to do good for the world?
I can't say, but I have, because of my own self-selection, I think I've surrounded myself with good quality people. So I'm sure my universe is highly skewed in the positive dynamic direction.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. All our lines are lighted up. Let's go back. Welcome to Work with Marty Nengpo and Sramana Mitra. What is your question or comment for her?
I want to get back to practical because we're running out of time.
Great.
Earlier in the show, you mentioned using Facebook for this very targeted audience. Can you get back to or just explain in a few steps what you would do as a small business person trying to launch and market your product?
Very good question. I'm glad you asked this question, because this is one actionable thing that you actually can do. Facebook has created an incredible machine that you can use to hyper-target to certain segments of prospects, you know, potential customers. And before you can use that effectively, you kind of need to analyze your business. And this is something we do all the time in my business, which is 1 million by 1 million, helping people figure out what is their positioning, what is the segment that is going to be the most responsive to whatever value proposition they are bringing to the table. And then once you figure that out, you can use Facebook's hyper-targeting capabilities to generate awareness in those segments. You need to go to Facebook's advertising. You kind of need to figure out how to use the Facebook advertising tools and be able to target, and so that you can take advantage of this phenomenon. You do need to learn how to take advantage of this. It's one of the top things, I would say. This, along with Google's paid search and search engine optimization, these are the three things, as small business owners, you would be able to get the maximum leverage out of.
No, and I normally, thank you very much for the call. When I think of Google paid search, when I do, I search Google constantly, and as soon as I see the paid ads, I immediately don't look at them because of two reasons. Number one, if somebody, my unconscious belief is that if somebody needs to pay for an ad, they're probably not as good as somebody who I could find through organic
search. This is not how the rest of the population functions. Mm-hmm. Google's paid search is a tremendously effective way of generating business, and I have done case study after case study of companies that have minted millions using that technique.
Let's go back to the phone. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemkos from Monomitra. What is your question or comment for her?
Yes, I have a question for her, and since she is aware a whole lot of what's taking place in different places, I'm sure she'll be able to help with this.
Mm-hmm.
In other countries, particularly in Europe, where you don't have the executives earning so much, and you don't have the poor people earning so little, there was an article about in Denmark how someone working at McDonald's, how well they can live. Could she please explain what she sees as being the difference? She had said that if you don't have strict capitalism, then you won't have the incentive to have new things develop. And yet somehow they seem to have achieved
well,
some
not
of those
as
goals.
Much new thing gets things get developed in Europe. If you actually pay attention, the really hardcore new stuff, the revolutionary stuff, is actually still happening in America. It's not happening in Europe. And you have to. So socialism protects the people who don't have jobs in Europe and get welfare and so forth. But these are. Europe is a very stagnated economy. Youth unemployment in Greece is 50%. In Spain, it's 35%. So Europe is not exactly a great example of how to do things.
You are saying for two countries. You mentioned, how about Norway and Denmark and Sweden?
Norway's advantage is that they have oil and gas.
No, Sweden certainly does not have oil and gas. Norway does, but Sweden and Denmark
do not.
And
these are tiny populations. Oh, these are tiny, tiny populations.
You keep shifting things around, I believe. It feels to me like you're shifting things around and selecting particular kind of things. When you speak about the incentives for people to earn a lot, do you think that we wouldn't have the development of good medications if the patent period was 8 years instead of 12 years?
Oh, that's another whole other topic.
You know what, we're
right?
getting. I think you know what we're getting. You know what, we're getting really too political. I think the show has got to focus on career, and this is a little bit too many steps away. I'm going to thank you for the call. We have time for one more question, and then I'm going to give you we're going to try to end on a practical, careerish note. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. My special guest, Mr. Monomitra, what is your question or comment for her?
Okay, am I on the air?
You are.
Okay. I've called before. I teach a class in the graduate engineering program and at Santa Clara University on career strategies for foreign-born high-tech professionals.
Great.
Given your guest's experience in Silicon Valley, your experience, do you think there's really a market for this in Silicon Valley as a whole outside of the university?
For career counseling of engineering graduates?
These are workshops for foreign-born immigrant engineers who want to understand the American workplace and to accelerate their careers in the American workplace.
I suppose so, because that is foreign-born. If you can work through the visa issues, which I think right now is a gigantic up-in-the-air question mark issue, there are tons of jobs because Silicon Valley continues to be in a talent war situation for engineering talent. So there is, you know, if to the extent that you're, you know, looking to help people navigate through to those jobs, I think there is, yes, there is, but the visa issue remains a big question mark.
Thank you.
Yeah,
for
these are people who already have visas.
Then that, I think that should be fine.
Great.
Both of them are already working in Silicon Valley. They just want to accelerate their careers and rise up the career ladder in Silicon Valley.
You know, all career counseling has a market. It really depends on how good you are.
Anyway, thank you for the call, Rick. That's certainly true. You know, it's there are places that sell food. There are places that do everything. The question in the end is really how good you are.
Yeah.
There's almost no idea that's bad. It's a matter of how well it's executed.
And capitalism, what I like about it is it generally rewards merit. And meritocracies, to me, are always welcome.
And from what I'm this constitutional moderate, and I think that in general, free and I'm curious what you really think about this. I think free market capitalism does yield innovation. It yields incentive and motivation, but it also too many losers. And
it yields inequality. Capitalism
right.
is structured to produce inequality.
Right.
And as a result of that, given where we are going and what capitalism is going to do to our society, capitalism is going to be dead in 30 years.
And that's why I think, especially in the aftermath of this election, and it just reinforces my, I am a constitutional moderate. And that's why my position is always about moderately regulated capitalism. There's no magic pill either way. You have pure socialism, you end up too little incentive, too little innovation. Pure capitalism, too many human losers. Therefore, moderately...
Which is why basic income, universal basic income, is totally an anti-capitalistic policy that needs to be in place as a safety net.
Precisely. So, but I want to end on a practical note. I want to ask you just an overall general softball question. As you're walking out of here, what is one more practical thing related to one's career or workplace that... is that in light of all your experience in Silicon Valley, you want to share not to the budding zillionaire, but to the budding $100,000 a year person who wants to make $100,000 a year? What's your, not some advice you haven't mentioned
Bootstrapping
yet.
With a paycheck. Start a company on the side. Because there is going to be a lot of disruption in the workplace in the upcoming years because of robotics, because of automation, because of automated code generators, etc., artificial intelligence, you are going to get disrupted very likely. So start thinking about what is a side business that you can create that helps you take control of your destiny. In 1 million by 1 million, the virtual accelerator that I run, this is something that I'm promoting heavily and we are supporting heavily, is people who want to start side businesses. We will coach you and you should start paying attention to this.
And your website is shramanamitra.com?
Also, and 1mbyonem.com. The number one, the letter M, B-Y, the number one, the letter M.com.
Okay. Say
1 million by 1 million. Just do a Google search on 1 million by 1 million. It'll bring you to us.
Perfect. Shramanamitra, thanks very much for being my guest again on Work with Marty Nemko.
It's been a great pleasure.
Yeah, I'm glad you don't think I interrupted you.
I don't think you interrupted me. No one interrupts me. I'm sorry. If you want to interrupt me, you'll get interrupted right back. No problem.
Exactly. We're gender equal interrupters. I do think it serves our listeners a lot better. Anyway, that is Work with Marty Nemko for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and of course all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do workovers on callers, I swear. I know you know that's an important part of the show. And Stoicism is a much misunderstood philosophy, and it's one that has significant implications for career and workplace. So I will talk with Ryan Holiday. He's the author of The Daily Stoic, 366 Meditations on Wisdom, Perseverance, and the Art of Living. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemko reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.